Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And let's see, what else are we supposed to say? Oh, yeah, we're supposed to say that The Personal Wealth Coach is also the name, not only a riveting radio program in the sense of hot steel being driven through your skin, but in the sense of the Personal Wealth Coach is also an SEC-registered investment advisory firm located in Salado, Texas, doing business all over the place. And nothing we say on this radio program should be construed to be investment advice. Instead, it's education. And if you want investment advice, you can certainly give us a call or come by and see us. And that's what we do, is we provide investment advice and management. But what we do on this radio program is just education and probably, to some degree, entertainment as we screw things up.
Right.
Does that cover it?
I think it covers it well.
We could say something like, information provided on this radio program has been obtained from sources deemed to be reliable but is not warranted or guaranteed to be true. But then again, that entertainment word probably covers all of that.
Right.
So, telephone number in here if you'd like to give us a call.
One thing to say is that we're going to try to make it true as we entertain. It's either going to be true or extremely sarcastic. Telephone numbers to call in here, or a number to call in here, is 254-773-1400.
Let's see. What has happened? Anything go on this week?
Let's see. Yeah, a lot of stuff happened this week. We had a day for every day of the week. We had an hour for every hour in those days, and corresponding minutes and seconds went with those.
And we had Freya's Day.
Freya's Day?
Yes, the last day of the working week.
Frigga. Frigga's Day.
Well, that's another way of saying it.
Yeah.
Same.
Not Freya. Freya is a different Norse god.
Frigga?
Is a different god than Frey. Yeah.
Really? I need to look that up. Okay. Anyway, so we had Frigg's Day. We had Thor's Day.
We had Woden's Day.
We had Woden's Day. Wednesday. We had Tuesday's Day.
Yeah.
And then we had, and I don't know, who's
Moon.
Mon?
Moon.
Moon?
And Sun.
So we had Sunday and then Moon Day.
Yes. So anybody that has lack of complaints in their life, you can begin complaining about the pagan gods that make up the days
of
the week.
And of course, today is the day of Saturn.
Yes.
Which is
Saturn's day.
Right.
Which is very strange because the sun, the moon, and Saturn are not Norse gods and the rest of the days are.
So we gotta research this and figure out where we got this mix of gods.
Well, the thing is, when you have a monotheistic culture and you have 7 days in the week, it gets really hard to figure out, I guess, how do you name the days?
We could name them like one,
two. Three. Well, you do that on the calendar, and that's pretty nice.
Yeah, well, we did until Augustus came along, who used to be Octavian, and started sticking.
Well, no, I mean, the 1-2 is in there. It's just for the months. You're right, though, in that it's completely arbitrary. It used to be 10 months in the year. That's what December means. Dec is 10. October's 8. Oct.
November's 9.
Right, but you've got, in the middle of that, you've got July and August, which are two arbitrary days. And just think about this. We think we have a weird political situation. The head of state says, I realize that my adopted father, who I've just named a god, by the way, spent a lot of time perfecting this calendar and putting exactly 10 months in it and figuring out exactly how many days are in each of those 10 months to make sure that we have a leap year every 4 years and all that good stuff so that we could use this calendar into the future. I'm going to put 2 more months in it as recognition of my own godhood and his godhood. Just in the middle of it, we're going to call it July and August for Julius and Augustus.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not going to change the names of the other months, which the upper months are by number.
Right.
So we're still
going to call 8, 9, and 10.
So June is Juno, okay? July is Julius. August is Augustus. And then you've got September.
Don't forget Janus at the beginning.
Yeah, Janus, Februs. So they've got gods at the beginning, but it ends in numbers. And the numbers go up to 10. But we're going to throw two more in there, but we're not going to change the numbers.
Right.
That sounds like something Congress would do.
Maybe Congress considers itself a god.
I realize we're still calling it October, and that means 8, but it's really 10.
Well,
but
that's
we're
all right.
And we're still going to call it 8, even though it's 10, forever. Maybe it's the IRS code
Actually, Congress has done that. They, you know, twice a year, they arbitrarily change the time.
Yes, but they at least they change the time so that you don't just have two random words that aren't even numbers appear and then continue as if they didn't happen. So that midnight is still at 12, but there's two extra hours in the day named something else. It goes 8, 9, jumpo,
give them,
bumpo,
give
10.
Give them time. They'll be we'll go 1, 2, 3, 4. We'll have an hour called Republican.
Right, and one called Democrat.
Right.
Right. And then immediately go on to 5, even though there's two extras in there that
That's
didn't
right.
add up.
That's right. Yes. We need 14 hours in a day.
Right.
Oh,
well, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Think of all
two
the things
extra
we could
hours
get done.
A day.
Yeah.
Wow.
Don't tell Congress. They may take that literally. Don't tell any party in.
Wait a minute. We could have an hour named Trump.
Yes, but the Democrats would want one named Obama, and then we'd have Trump Obama, and then you couldn't put those 2 hours next to each other, or your clock would break.
Well, okay, let's see what happened in the market this week. If you're looking at the S&P 500, it was down a whopping 0.30%. Actually, on Friday, it was up for a little while, and then it was down, and then it was back, and then it ended almost exactly where it began the week. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average ended up 0.30. The NASDAQ was down a bit, 1.55%. And this is really fascinating. The headlines are about the tech wreck and the crash of the tech market. And the Dow was up and the S&P 500 was down so little that you really have to have a micrometer to measure it. So what happened? What was the big news that caused the fangs to go on? You know, they're called the fangs now.
Facebook,
Apple. Anyway, basically
Netflix, Google. Only it's not Google anymore. It's Alphabet. So you just messed up the acronym.
But they still call it fangs.
Right.
Anyway, what caused, let's see, Apple, Google, Facebook, and other tech names, they would call it. Well, you have to throw FEMGAs, what it's called in some places now, because Microsoft has been thrown in there by other
people. Oh, yeah. Well, we've got to come up with a really good unrepeatable acronym.
Right.
And then just use it a lot, and people will have no idea what we're talking about.
But they want to buy some of that.
Yeah.
Why did it go down? No reason.
Well, there were reasons.
People
were selling it more than people were buying
right.
it.
Right. But as far as what caused the people to start selling, there was a report that came out from Goldman Sachs just before the selling started that said these stocks have had very little volatility.
Oh, that's scary.
And that's what they said. They said that it has such low volatility that sooner or later something's going to happen. And it did. And then people bought them back again. But the key this week in the market's non-behavior. The non-event in the market, you really got to be really old like I am to remember the 1970s, early 1970s, when Watergate was going on and there were these Senate hearings where a lawyer got up and said there'd been this and there'd been that and there'd been the other and do you have any evidence of that? No, but I saw it and I heard it. And it was amazingly similar this week. But in the 1970s, every time the lawyer would open his mouth or a witness would open his mouth and Senator Irwin's eyebrows would shoot up, the market would drop. And it's absolutely fascinating to me, having been around through that, to watch the market not drop. I mean, Theresa May is probably the big real reason the market was down just a little bit. If you got the S&P.
Yeah, there was an election. For those of you that don't follow news outside of the United States, there was an election for Parliament in Great Britain, in the UK. And it was held, the way they do it is the Prime Minister can call an election at any point. They can say, we'll have an election, and they usually do it to try to increase their power base. They're trying to get more seats in Parliament for their party so that they can go forward with an agenda that they really want to push. If they think that the people of the United Kingdom greatly support them, then they say, well, let's hold an election, and I'll get some more support from this. We'll get more votes in Parliament. She judged it wrong. That's a big understatement.
I've read a lot of commentary on that, and a lot of people are on the inside were commenting on it before it even happened. And basically, Theresa May wasn't actually elected.
No.
In the standard way, she was chosen by her party, but she
was elected as a member of Parliament.
She was elected a member of Parliament.
It'd be like if we selected our president, if the Congress selected our president out of their own members, kind of like they do the Speaker of the House.
Right. As a matter of fact, she is roughly the equivalent of the Speaker of the House.
But the Speaker of the House, in equivalency over in the United Kingdom, is also kind of the equivalent of the president there. So the Prime Minister is literally the most important minister, and that's how it's selected. So go ahead.
And they're just – it was an interesting article that indicated that, of course, she was already prime minister when President Trump was elected. And
right.
She made up her mind after President Trump's election because it sounds kind of weird from over here looking back over there. But she kind of sees President Trump's position of dictating what happens and making executive orders. And she wants to do that, particularly with regard to leaving the European Union. She wants to be the boss, and she wants her word to hold sway, and she wants what's called a hard Brexit. She wants some pretty radical things done compared with what a lot of other people wanted. So
right.
She thought calling this election would result in a similar to Trump result. And unfortunately, she went from having a majority, her party, having a majority
in Parliament
to having a minority in Parliament and having to –
it's still the largest minority.
Right.
She's got to have an alliance with another minority party in order to get anything passed.
And she's working hard on an alliance with Northern Ireland Unity Party. Whoa. Who has got a completely different agenda, and so
that just made her job a lot harder.
And she hasn't got that alliance yet, so they basically don't have a government right now.
Right. So let's throw this in perspective. Theresa May became prime minister after the Brexit vote, after the United Kingdom voted to leave the European Union.
Just barely.
She's in the same party as the former prime minister who did not want
Conservatives.
Yeah, did not want to leave the European Union. The Prime Minister prior did not, and Theresa May, who worked for him, also did not want to leave the European Union. But once that vote went, she considered it her job, once she became Prime Minister, to do the will of the people of the United Kingdom as she saw it. Well, it's difficult to do a job that you don't really agree with. And the way she wanted to do it would likely have the worst short-term impact on Great Britain, on the United Kingdom.
A lot of her positions with regard to immigration, with regard to tariffs, with regard to a lot of things, are not that different from President Trump's positions. She doesn't tweet, so we don't get to see the more volatile side if she has one. This is one of those things, one of those realities out there that's definitely affected the British market. And I think the dip we saw on Friday was at least partially result of the UK vote.
People don't realize this, but London is still the center of trade for the world.
Right.
Manhattan takes a close second.
One of the things that also came out this week is that the various polls, and there's a lot of them, where people say we approve or disapprove of President Trump. Now, 54 to 57% disapprove, and there's different numbers with different polls. One of the most significant issues here, to me at least, is when Fox's poll says only 40% of the population, of the voting population, approve of President Trump and 54% disapprove of President Trump. That's significant. And I think that's what she ran into in when they voted for Brexit. A lot of people said, we want change.
Right.
We don't like the current situation. But as they became more and more familiar with the what change amounted to,
the alternatives,
they changed their mind. They did want change, so they changed their mind.
Right.
And I think, very frankly, I think if President Trump were to run a parliamentary election today.
Yeah, he wouldn't run a parliamentary election today. I think he's a lot smarter than doing that.
You'd see a similar result. And by the way, this we're saying this not because of politics, but because it echoes back in on what's going on in the United States and in Congress. We've got a caller. Let's talk about that a little more. We're going to get down to the nitty-gritty of it. It has to do, of course, with tax reform, health care reform, the key issues that economically are going to affect us. And
correct.
We have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, I tuned in late. Have you guys talked about the Dodd-Frank yet?
No.
No.
Okay.
We will, though.
The paper, okay, I was just curious, what would be the impact? Is it a good thing? And so I'm sure you'll cover that. Thank you.
I can give you a very simple
thanks for the call.
The House passed a Dodd-Frank reform bill that basically stripped a lot of the regulatory protections that were stuck in there under Dodd-Frank. And they did so pretty crudely, knowing that the Senate would never in their wildest dreams approve of that bill.
Let's hit this real quick. This is it dovetails nicely into what we were already talking about. Dodd-Frank was I don't know of any well-renowned economist that thinks that Dodd-Frank was not an overreaction.
Sausage.
Yeah. Dodd-Frank was a direct response to the crash, the recession, the banking issues that took place that led up to the Great Recession. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the pieces in it that have been around and been debated for decades, the things that we need to do to help prevent too big to fail and that sort of thing, were good. But then they were mixed in with a lot of sausage. And the regulatory requirements for a company are off the charts. We have roughly half the number of publicly traded companies that we had about 15 years ago. What that means is that companies are going to private investors for their funding, which is a much more difficult process than what we had for going public several decades ago. When Dodd-Frank passed, it required some really good things. Like, for instance, the CEO has to sign off on the earnings under penalty of law. If the CEO knowingly signs that report that says the earnings are there, when the earnings are not there, they can go to prison. Well, that's something that I think is really, really important. The ongoing filing requirements that Dodd-Frank imposes are drastic. They're draconian. There are estimates going in multiple directions. The difference in going public as far as the cost of accounting is tens of millions of dollars per year. And I realize that there are big, big companies out there worth many billions of dollars, but it's really, really rare for a company to IPO for more than $1 billion. It's pretty normal for it to be around $100 million. And if $15 million or $10 million is the extra expense to do accounting so that you can do that, it doesn't make sense. That's 10% of the value of a company.
We certainly see the excesses in Dodd-Frank and have felt the excesses in Dodd-Frank. The problem is with the bill that passed the House.
Yes.
Is it was instead of it's basically Dodd-Frank. The body of Dodd-Frank requires some fine scalpel surgery, for instance, to lift the restrictions on small banks without lifting the trading restrictions on large banks that got them into trouble. The bill that passed the House lifts the trading restrictions, period, meaning right now they're in a position, the large banks are in a position where they can't do what are called risky trades. They can't do high risk, high potential gain, high potential loss trades using FDIC-insured money.
Right. Depositors' money.
The bill that passed the House of Representatives says no problem, and it also removes the liquidation authority that was established and says they can just declare bankruptcy if they fail.
Except then you really would strain the FDIC coverage, and this is a law that would never pass the Senate.
So
and the Republicans in the House knew that, but so basically we were looking at this as a political statement of we don't like Dodd-Frank. I can agree with that. We don't like Dodd-Frank either. But you got to be careful because there's a baby in the bathwater.
It is very similar to the health care bill that passed the House of Representatives finally that wasn't scored by the Congressional Budget Office before it passed. This one wasn't either, by the way. And as a result, once the Congressional Budget Office looks at it and says, A, this will cost us a gazillion dollars, and B, it will cause a lot of people a lot of unhappiness – then all of a sudden it becomes, oh, well, maybe we shouldn't have voted for that, except for the fact that when I got home, I can say I promised to repeal Dodd-Frank and I promised to repeal Obamacare. So I voted for two different bills and they passed the House. The problem is
neither of those bills have
right.
chance of becoming law.
They
cannot happen the way they stand.
So, and then when the Senate rewrites it, as they're attempting to do on health care, and says, okay, this is a more responsible way to do it, which will take a while.
Then the House won't agree with it because
right.
it doesn't go far enough.
And that dovetails very nicely into what we were talking about with Theresa May and
right.
Donald Trump.
This is the point, yeah.
And that is that Donald Trump was elected and a Republican majority was elected in both the House and the Senate based on the promise of doing some things, reforming health care, and part of that promise was nobody loses their health insurance and everybody gets less expensive health insurance. That's A. B, rejiggering, reforming, rewriting the tax code so that it ceases to be the labyrinth of inconsistencies that we see today that, again, costs us phenomenally in preparation and regulatory costs. Then there were some other things that were in there, like building the border wall, which, if you'll notice, has kind of slipped off into the background. Nobody
right.
talks about anymore. But frankly, we're in it.
Are we still talking about
all three of those things?
Frank, are we talking about it frankly?
Yes.
So
yes.
Okay. All right.
All of those things were possible, but they were dependent upon somebody like Ronald Reagan who could bring bipartisan support over a series of several years to getting the job done and bring the government in to support it. And whether or not you like Donald Trump, there's a simple, very, very, very profound fact out there right now. And that is there are, well, like 480 some, I've got the exact numbers here somewhere, positions, critical positions in the federal government that the president or the administration has to nominate and the Senate has to approve. There's like 520 altogether that are not. No one's even been nominated. No one's been vetted. No one has been checked for. For instance, using the State Department, which is easy, we see what goes on in the State Department. There are like 120 undersecretaries of state for various parts of the world, and it's critical to have an undersecretary of the state, for example, for Japan. Why? Well, because when the Japanese want to coordinate something with the United States government, they call up somebody who understands Japan and who speaks Japanese and who can coordinate what's going on with the State Department. Well, the problem is there's nobody in that position. There's nobody in the China position. There's nobody in the Southeast Asia position.
What's more, and just staying on Japan for a minute, we have an ambassador to Japan. But now when the ambassador needs to get some information to the United States about a deal, some kind of a trade something or another, some kind of mission or message, that person either has to call the Secretary of State, which really makes the Secretary of State's job incredibly confusing because you're going to get calls constantly from every part of the world, or call a low-level bureaucrat that doesn't have the ability to make a decision can only hand the message up to the Secretary of State.
Wait, here's the numbers. I've actually got the numbers in front of me now. There's 1,000, approximately 1,200 positions that the president or the administration, actually the president formally, has to nominate and the Senate has to approve. Of those, 559 are what are called key positions, without which, by law, that section of the government can't do anything. I mean, they can keep on doing what they were doing before, but they can't actually change anything or change policy. They have to have a signature by an undersecretary of something or another that has to be appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate. Now, of the 559 key positions, 428 of those have no nominees.
Now, let me throw something in here. This is an area where people can respond by saying the Democrats will just obstruct it. They'll threaten to filibuster. The Democrats and the Republicans for undersecretaries have used the nuclear option repeatedly for a long – this is not new here. This is one that the Democrats were using it for federal court appointments. Undersecretaries fall very similarly into that category of, okay, we will – do a majority vote based on the rule that you're not allowed to filibuster at this level of government, which means it's just a matter of appointing the people. The votes are there. The votes are there, but they haven't been appointed, which means that we have in many areas of foreign affairs a non-functional government.
They not only have they not been appointed, they haven't been nominated. There's only 8 positions before the Senate awaiting nomination right now, which is out of 428 no nominees, 8 awaiting nomination, there are 83 that have been formally nominated, and we've only confirmed 40. And by the way, again, when we say the Senate has confirmed 40, this is a Republican. It only takes 51 votes in the Senate to confirm.
And they've got 52 unless you count the vice president for tie-breaking, and then you got 53.
So this is one of the issues that's going on right now in the United States government that is, frankly, a little bit worrisome. Fortunately, we have some very good institutions, but it's one of the reasons that if you look around the world, you see the Chinese are undertaking diplomatic initiatives and doing some things that
we've left a power vacuum.
We have nobody in a position to recommend to the Secretary of State. There's only one, I think, there's either one or two undersecretaries of state now, as opposed to the 100 and some that are supposed to be there, which means that the Secretary of State is overwhelmed and the rest of the State Department is not able to do anything. And that's also true in Treasury, by the way. That's also true in the other departments. And if you believe that, okay, the smart thing to do is for government to do nothing, then that's a big plus. And it's also probably saving us some significant money because there are 428 plus relatively six-figure income positions in the United States government that aren't being filled. The problem is, as long as there's no undersecretary of state to execute a policy change initiated by the White House, we keep the Obama level, the previous Obama set regulatory environment.
Right.
And
so the change that was promised there isn't being provided because there's no one there to provide the change.
And this isn't political. This is simply a commentary, if you will. It's an observation on what's going on. Historically, at this point in the presidency, there have been presidents nowhere near this far behind on nomination, but behind. They have typically worked weekends to put their nominees in place, and the administration is not working weekends to put their nominees in place for some reason. I don't understand why, and it could be a conscious decision. They just don't want government to make decisions.
Yeah, and this may go along with – let's say this clearly. The president in the campaign said very clearly that he didn't want to replace government workers unless they were needed. And his definition of needed may be different than ours.
Right.
This is, they're not replacing government employees that leave through attrition. If they're retiring or moving to another job, they're not replacing them, which is part of what his original plan was. The difficulty with that is that at some point you're going to hit critical areas that do need to have people hired to replace them. And then we start getting into dangerous area. For instance, the Social Security Administration is getting short-staffed. If you call in because they sent you the wrong amount of money and there's nobody there to talk to you for 48 hours because they're short-staffed, you can see where we're getting into problems. We're cutting the budget, and I agree with cutting the budget, but we're doing it the kind of the same way that sequestration did, which is just cut everything. I don't care if it's vital or not, just cut everything at the same time, because that'll mean that we have to do something later.
Well, that leads to another one, which is pretty fascinating to me on the negative side of things this week. And that is the survey of economists and traders by the Wall Street Journal indicated that their number one concern right now was not one that I was even paying attention to. And that is that the government ran out of money on March 1st.
Yeah, debt ceiling's coming up.
They're shuffling money, and at some point we're going to hit the debt ceiling. Nobody knows exactly when, but there is no guidance from the White House, and there is deep division within the Republicans on what needs to be done to accomplish this. The conservatives in the House particularly are taking a hardline position of cut spending somewhere, a bunch.
The Secretary of the Treasury has said that he would like the debt ceiling raised before summer recess.
And I don't think it's going to happen.
I don't think it's going to happen. And this is an area where Congress is having a lot of trouble with the concept that the party in power is the majority power in the House. They're used to being obstructionist against another party. And I've spoken about this on the air before. The majority of the Republican representatives in Congress, in the House, were not in office when there was a Republican president. They got into office by saying that they were against some things and they were going to keep these things from happening. Now they're in power and they have the opportunity to do the things that they've been saying they want to do and roll back the things that they've been saying they want to roll back, but they can't agree on how it happens. And it's pure politics. And I realize that it sounds like we're being down on the Republicans here. We said the same thing during Barack Obama's first term when Nancy Pelosi was in charge. Mm-hmm. They got one major bill done, that was the Affordable Care Act, and then they lost all momentum and started infighting, and they lost the majority of the House immediately on the first election after the presidential. And that's the danger for the Republican Party. If they don't figure out how to get working with each other, then they look like failures. They have all of the tools available to do the things that they've been claiming they want to do for 8 years, and they're not doing it. That's a problem. And there's a big storm in all the hearings over Comey and the probes into Russia and all of that. But the fact that the government cannot move on to do the things that they've been saying they want to do for a long time, the things, the backbiting within the Republican Party, is their own worst enemy right now. They can get things done, but they're not. They're not agreeing with each other. They're not coming together. And this, I mean, I could keep kicking on that one. It's what seems to happen whenever we get one party that's in charge of the executive and legislative branches. It just seems to fall apart.
And there is already a bit of an effect that we're seeing on that in the United States economy, and that is the Eurozone economy this year so far is growing faster than the U.S. economy, despite the fact the Eurozone economy is not in the world's greatest shape.
No, it's not.
And that's kind of a weirdness. And you can expect to see, in my humble opinion,
or not so humble.
Well, okay. you can expect to see more of this coming, and it isn't going to be a pleasant experience. I remember the long, drawn-out years of leading up to the culmination of Watergate and a vice president who was never elected taking over. I don't know that we're going to go that far down the road, but it's one of those things where I know a lot of people, and to some degree I'm the same way, tune in to see the reality show every day to see what new revelations have popped up.
So much of what pops up is based on your own pre-existing opinion of who's right. So a lot of people, after watching for instance, the Comey hearings, said he's a horrible person. I could turn around from that conversation and hear the exact opposite, that Comey is a saint. Then he's neither of those. He's a high-level bureaucrat that was trying to do his job, but is certainly politically motivated as well. He definitely likes the limelight. But he also looks like he's got a good career with no black marks, that he's worked really hard to do what's best for the FBI. So, I mean, he's a human. Anyway, we got some commercials to
play. And
we
got some good news to come in on the other side. It's just one of the things I think we need to be aware of. If you're kind of secretly rejoicing to see everything kind of blow up in Washington, you might rethink that position a little bit, because we stand to be potentially hurt down the road on this. We'll talk about it more, but tax reform, it's not dead, but it's on life support and critical condition in ICU.
Yeah. So we'll be back on the other side if you'd like to join us. The phone number in here is 773-1400. That's 254-773-1400. We'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone number in here, 254-773-1400. We have a call?
Yeah, we do.
We have a call on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. I think it would be an interesting survey to have your callers call in and say, what are the top three things that you wished Congress and the president would be working on today? And I'll bet you none of those top three things is James Comey or Russia.
You got it. Man, is that ever an accurate statement?
Right. The fact is that there is a special prosecutor already whose job it is
special
to do this.
Special counsel.
Yeah, special counsel. And his job is to investigate this. The hearings in the Senate or in Congress will provide us only reality television
entertainment.
They don't do anything unless impeachment hearings begin, and it's absurd that they're spending the time that they have available in this sort of thing when there's so many important things they need to get to.
And I'll say, caller, I think if anybody said what we'd like to hear in tweets from the president, I don't think we want to hear about Comey. We don't want to hear about anything else like that. What I would like to hear is, we're making good progress on the budget. Here's what we're doing, and not just really, really good, but specifics on what we're doing to get
the plan
healthcare
on healthcare. Here's the plan on tax reform. These are why he's in office.
And I don't think, very frankly, nobody that I can see is paying a lot of – well, Paul Ryan is. I'll give Representative Ryan his due.
He's trying to keep his head out of the thing. It makes him sound horrible in the press when he's like, I'm not trying to look at that right now. Yeah, it sounds bad, but let's get back to the agenda of what we're supposed to be doing.
He still is focused on tax reform. He feels like he's passed the ball on health care reform to the Senate, and he'd like to get a tax reform bill out, and frankly, he is not getting a lot of attention from the Republicans, particularly the Freedom Caucus.
Yeah.
They're saying, we want some things, we want a major cut in several areas, and they want to revisit health care, among other things, in the House to make bigger cuts, or we're not going to support raising the debt ceiling of the United States, which would shut the government down. So we're back in this headbutting contest. And
now we said we were going to have some good news. So we've clicked on the political side. People say you guys cover politics a lot. We're covering politics, hopefully from a nonpartisan perspective, from an economic perspective. And that's something that it's a huge part of the economy is the policy that's set forth by the Federal Reserve, which is government oriented, and by the Congress and by the president. Trade is important. And the fact that the budget of the United States government is a huge chunk of our economy, it's right up there with healthcare. When we've got we've got about 40% of our economy, of our ongoing value and spending in our economy between healthcare and the government budget up in the air. It's really hard to look at the other things like productivity or, you know, when you have an incremental 1 or 2% change in the growth of the GDP, we can look at that and say that's good news. But if 40% of the economy is completely unpredictable based on the whimsy of politics, that's when we want to cover politics and say, hey, things are a bit absurd right now.
There's a fascinating little piece of evidence as to why the markets continue to be high and the economy continues, despite the reports, to be good. We, from last year at this time, so far in 2017, are on the way to doubling our oil exports from last year, which was a record high.
Right. And our liquid gas exports are probably three times what they were 2 years ago, and they're about to get a lot bigger.
The we're now exporting approximately 1 million barrels of oil a day, which sounds like a lot. Obviously, that would be around 365 million barrels of oil.
So all of this is covered in millions of barrels a day. So I'm going to throw out some things in there that will help folks understand what's going on. The United States produces almost 10 million barrels of oil a day, about 9.8 million barrels of oil a day. OPEC, the whole group of OPEC, produces about 31 million. So we're not actually producing more than OPEC as a group. We are number three in the world, in that Russia and Saudi Arabia individually are way up there. Russia's producing about 10 million a day, and Saudi Arabia is producing just over 10 million. So Russia's a little bit ahead of Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia's a little bit ahead of us. The difference is that we're coming in with cheaper oil at a time when they're used to not having a supply coming from the United States. Our 1 million barrels a day is the perfect size to completely disrupt the current oil change.
And throw in there the fact that we're exporting, and notice that these are much more expensive items, approximately 9 million barrels a day of refined petroleum product.
Right, because they're being shipped to the United States to be refined mm-hmm. and then shipped back sometimes and exactly to the place that they were mined out of the ground, pumped out of the ground.
The OPEC got together and even got the Russians to agree, and everybody agreed and said, we'll cut our output, and that way the price of oil went up a little bit. And then it promptly plunged back down below $50 recently, and the reason it plunged back down below $50 is because the United States said, oh, wow, oil producers across the United States, and the fracking said, we can make a good profit there. Let's pump more oil.
Yeah, and this is something that's a big factor in that. The technology for fracking has not stopped. I mentioned this at the beginning of the year that as of this year, with one rig, we can get twice the production of what we got the year before in a fracking well. Well, coming very soon, we're talking about a four-time increase because the technology that is the money that's being applied to the technological innovation here, it's already been applied. They're just refining it now. So if you think of it as like an internal combustion engine, the Model T had to be refined all the way up to whatever we have at the top of the line today, we're doing that refining of the technology much faster now.
And we're also refining technology.
Yes. So you throw the two together, and we're doing things a lot cheaper here. The reason why the rest of the world isn't fracking is because they don't know how.
Well, that there's a certain amount. The American companies, for instance, could have gone into Great Britain, and there's a lot of oil available to be fracked in Great Britain.
But Great Britain said, no, you can't frack here.
They said, you can't frack here because you'll cause minor earthquakes and maybe mess with our water.
We're doing it anyway here. Yeah. Now, in Texas, we have Texas, by the way, has about 3.8 million barrels a day being produced here. It is a single largest source, and if it were a member of OPEC, it would be one of the top five, just to throw that out there. So Texas is, and if you throw in offshore drilling, whatever, you add that in, and we are up at the top two. Saudi Arabia is ahead of us. Iraq and Iran are both ahead. But that concept of the amount that we're producing, and it just a few years ago, in order to be profitable, a fracking oil well needed on average about a $90 a barrel price in order to pump it out and be profitable. Now we're looking at a $40 a barrel, and just a few years, it may be that we'll be profitable at $20 a barrel. And that means a lot more will be pumped, and we won't be pumping 9.8 million at that point. It'll be more like 20 million.
Well, you know, that's looking at the supply side, but looking at the other side, the buyer side on oil, there's some fascinating things going on, at least to me. China is our fastest growing customer. If we, you know, of course, different companies have different customers, but if we look at nations and we see who is accelerating their purchase of U.S. oil fastest, ironically, it's China, and the Chinese actually are very uncomfortable with their dependency on OPEC nations in Southwest Asia.
There's another area that's growing very, very rapidly, and this is in the liquid natural gas area.
Mm-hmm. That's Europe, right?
Eastern Europe.
Right.
Eastern Europe and France. France, by the way, is doing fantastically, and when you talk about the Paris Accords, and we've talked about the silliness of the Paris Accords, that a lot of people made a lot of promises and there aren't a lot of people in line to actually hitting those promises. Germany is going the wrong direction. Their emissions are way up over what they were 5 years ago, while the United States is way down. France is way down. Well, the story of France is, well, let's hit Germany first. Germany closed down all its nuclear power. After Fukushima in Japan, the Germans said, no, we don't want that.
You never can tell. They might get a tidal wave.
And an earthquake in the middle of Germany.
Well, it wasn't just the earthquakes. The tidal wave did the big deal.
Yeah,
so you never can
earthquake,
tell.
Tidal wave in Germany is a big danger.
Right.
So they shut down all of their nuclear power plants and opened up a bunch of coal plants. Well, the reason why they opened a bunch of coal plants is because that was the cheapest to get at the time. Liquid natural gas needs tankers and pipelines in place. And those pipelines are being put in place in France, and they've got good ports in France. France is meeting the Paris Accords not because it's somehow figured out a bunch of ways of going and doing alternative fuel or whatever. It's an alternative fuel. It's liquid natural gas. They are pumping a lot of liquid natural gas from the United States. It's very inexpensive. It's a lot less expensive than coal. And the carbon emissions are a lot less. So it's not the Paris Accords that's allowing France to do this. It's economics. It's less expensive to get liquid natural gas. And so that's what they're doing. Eastern Europe is terrified of Russia. Russia is overcharging them drastically.
Why?
I don't understand why.
Why would they be terrified of Russia?
Putin wants peace. Peace of this and peace of that. So they're terrified. I mean, all you have to do is look at Azerbaijan, Georgia, Ukraine to understand why they're terrified. There's your comfortable relationship with your neighboring nation until they take a big chunk of your country. That's a little scary. So liquid natural gas is a greater threat to Europe or to Russia than NATO is. And that's saying something, and that the revenue from the for the government of Russia, the majority of that revenue comes from oil, and we're threatening their oil. So the just know that that's out there as well. Their interests don't align with either party in the United States. Their interest aligns in chaos. So even if they were involved in the election, and it's the evidence is pretty clear that they were involved in sending out a bunch of fake news, they are enjoying the fact that we're shutting down our government, in effect, to try to figure out what's going on, if any laws have been violated, and chasing our own tail.
We need Maxwell Smart. Remember his the opponent organization is Chaos?
Yes. So anyway, we're about out of time for this hour.
I think we do. We need to get Maxwell Smart and send him to Washington.
Yeah.
And that would solve the entire problem, right?
Yeah, just his shoe phone would be the way that the State Department would contact the whole world.
Yeah, I mean, it would work.
Yeah, it could happen.
But we're about out of time, and you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach on this June the 10th of 2017. And if you'd like to contact us off the air, we do manage investment portfolios and do financial planning and coordination for higher net worth portfolios. And our telephone number locally is 254-947-1111.
You can reach it toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. There's voicemail during the weekend and real live people answering the phone during the week. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, and listen to the podcasts of this show and many others. You can look at our ugly mugs made for radio and our beautiful staff. This is something the podcaster, you should do at your own risk. Until next hour, this is
KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood, the best talk in America. News Radio 1400 KTEM.